This is an ABC podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas Ariti. Coming up this Friday, drought, bushfires and now border closures. Regional communities in Victoria and New South Wales come to terms with the uncertainty. And as the pandemic continues, one of the biggest unanswered questions has been why some people are so severely affected while others hardly have any symptoms at all. We'll speak to a researcher at the front line of the effort to understand why.
What we're discovering now and others around the world is that it creates a whole lot of other effects too. Potentially diabetes, heart risk, liver damage, brain damage, you name it, this one can do it. It is the Pandora's box of diseases.
Well, this lunchtime, the normally bustling streets of Melbourne's CBD are quiet. Cafes, pubs and restaurants are closed. People are being told to stay at home. The Victorian government's expecting this second lockdown will cost the economy billions of dollars. And in response, it's announced a new round of business support funding to the tune of $534 million. We'll begin today's coverage in Melbourne. Our reporter Samantha Donovan has the latest.
Melbourne's trams are running down empty streets, and away from the city, accommodation providers and other tourism businesses are suffering because many residents of the lockdown zone have had to cancel their school holiday trips. Tim Pallas is the Victorian Treasurer.
This is nowhere where any Victorian wanted to be, but it's the reality of the situation that we confront, and the obligation upon us all is to put our best efforts towards helping everybody make it through to the other side of this event.
Mr. Pallas has this morning announced a new round of support for Victorian businesses. It includes small cash grants for 80,000 businesses, $30 million for the hospitality sector, mental health support, support for tourism operators and a $20 million boost for the CBD. Mr. Pallas says after Victoria began to emerge from its first lockdown, he was optimistic the hit to the state's economy wouldn't be as bad as he expected when the pandemic began. But this second lockdown in Melbourne and the Mitchell Shire has him reverting to the gloomy forecasts of March.
We're expecting that there will be literally billions of dollars written off the expected size of the Victorian economy. We anticipate that our unemployment rate is likely to peak at 11%. What are we, 6.9% now? We're also expecting to see gross state product to decline by about 14%. That is a profound reduction, and it will take some years before we see that level of economic activity come back.
As to whether the federal government will make its JobKeeper program available beyond the planned national September cutoff, Mr. Pallas says he's in regular contact with his federal counterpart, Josh Frydenberg.
It's that September-December period, can I say, that we're most concerned about at the moment, largely because of the point at which a lot of government support is currently scheduled to fall away.
There are some happy Melburnians today. Residents of 8 of the 9 high-rise public housing towers that went into hard lockdown last Saturday are now joining the rest of the city in stage 3 restrictions and free to at least go outside for some fresh air. 26-year-old Aman Ali is among them.
First thing what I'm going to do is to walk around, a bit of exercise and then go back home. Excellent. Stretch my leg. All for the best. Finally, we're free. We're out now. It was hard for last 2 days. I got used to it. They did a great job, thanks to the Australian police.
But residents of one tower in North Melbourne must stay inside for another 8 days. Many of them are patients of CoHealth, a community health organisation in Melbourne's inner west. Its GP, Bronwyn Wells, has been in the towers to check on her patients this week. She spoke to ABC Radio Melbourne.
It's a very community-minded group of people in those towers. They've lived together for many, many, many years, and they're looking out for each other. You know, these are people who have often been through a lot in their lives already, and they know about crises and surviving crises. And there's an enormous amount of resilience in this community.
Melbourne GP Dr. Bronwyn Wells and Samantha Donovan with that report. Well, the border between Queensland and New South Wales has just reopened after 15 weeks of quarantined closure. But sadly, the welcome mat isn't out for Victorians or anyone who's travelled through Victoria in the past fortnight. Our reporter Rachel Mealy is monitoring the situation. She joins me now. Afternoon, Rachel. I'm hearing about 20-kilometre delays at that Tweed Heads-Coolangatta border so far.
Yeah, that's right, Tom. Cars have been lined up at that crossing for many hours now, waiting for the border to reopen, and that has just happened. Police have been making their way along the line of cars and checking border passes and asking drivers and their passengers about their movements over the past couple of weeks. There are a lot of camper vans, caravans, camper trailers in the line, lots of other cars packed to the gills with luggage. At the New England Highway crossing, it's a bit of a similar scene, a lot of caravans there as well. I think the Grey Nomad Brigade is on its way to Queensland, it seems. And Tom, a little bit of happy news today. Love is in the air. Our reporter on that crossing, Lucy Robinson, has just met a man who's on his way to meet a woman who he's been dating online for the past few months.
I haven't met her yet. We've met online, so.
So this is going to be your first time?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Very much so.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Best of luck indeed. Craig Dixon speaking to ABC reporter Lucy Robinson on the Queensland border there. Rachel Mealy's with me. Rachel, what about tourism operators around the state? They must be feeling a little more positive today, I imagine.
Look, Tom, it is obviously a positive day for all those hotels and tourist attractions across the state, but they've endured some really hard months, as you can imagine, and flights are about to land at Cairns Airport carrying tourists for the first time, and Cairns Airport is making a big deal about those first arrivals. They're putting on water cannon on the tarmac for the planes. I spoke to Steve Edmondson, who runs a charter sailing company in Port Douglas in far north Queensland. He says business for him has picked up a bit in anticipation of the borders reopening, but he's expecting it to take some time before he's back to anything resembling normal.
It'll be slow to pick up. So yes, we're hugely encouraged. We don't need lots of people and we have a really cool product and experience for our domestic market. So that's all great. But you think of how many people come in a plane and how many beds and activities they are to do. It'll be very diluted uptake, you know, because it does take time to get that momentum. But we're really encouraged that they have kept with the roadmap and people can come and seek us out.
Steve Edmondson from Sail Away in Port Douglas, speaking there to Rachel Mealy. We're going to head to Canberra now, where the Prime Minister's been chairing this morning's meeting of National Cabinet. Our political reporter Tom Iggledon joins us now. Afternoon, Tom. So there have been some pretty big developments since National Cabinet last met. That was 3 weeks ago. What's on the agenda?
Well, Tom, as you say, a very packed agenda. And look, it'll probably focus largely on those border closures around Victoria. The Deputy Prime Minister and Nationals leader, Michael McCormack, went on Radio National this morning and said he'd like to see that border situation more fluid, making life, it seems, particularly hard for a lot of agricultural producers along that border region. Of course, against that, there will be the normal health advice provided and an update there with a suggestion that it could be weeks until we know whether the virus has actually broken out of Victoria. Despite that lockdown, there'll, of course, again be another economic update. The Treasurer's been on record saying that it's costing about $1 billion a week due to that border closure. Also saying this morning that might factor into the government's thinking about the future of things like JobKeeper and JobSeeker. And finally, Tom, we have the international border for the National Cabinet to consider as well. A review's been done into the safe capacity of the hotel quarantine system. Now, of course, that Melbourne is cut out of that system, that is going to limit the number of people that Australia accepts back into the country, and perhaps we might get some details upon the closing of the meeting today about exactly how many people that will be, Tom.
Okay, now while we've got you there, Tom, Parliament's powerful Joint Committee on Security and Intelligence has been inquiring into new ASIO powers this morning. What's come up there?
Yeah, pretty interesting morning at that inquiry, Tom. Actually, these new espionage laws have drawn criticism from the Law Council, who says they're very broad and they give ASIO extraordinary new powers without the kind of normal independent oversight that you would see for these laws normally. David Neil from the Law Council has been saying he, in fact, thinks it's quite frightening, these laws, and not the kind of laws that you would normally see in liberal democracies. And he's even compared them to the controversial Chinese laws passed just recently with regard to Hong Kong and national security there. He says, on the face of it, the Australian laws might actually be more concerning because the Chinese laws deal with sedition, whereas it's a much broader definition in these new ASIO laws. Let's have a listen to what he told the inquiry.
The words of that legislation may not, probably don't, mirror what the realities of this, is, this Chinese law is. However, we are very concerned that legislation of this country that you'd be that the agents of ASIO would be entitled to detain compulsorily people for 40 hours to question them about things which are detrimental to the interests of Australia because they've been talking to someone who's classified as a foreign power about those things, keeping in mind that it's not someone who's actually going to do something which is detrimental to it, but simply someone who may have information about that.
David Neal from the Law Council of Australia there. Before him, our reporter Tom Eagledon in Canberra. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks very much for your company. The head of the World Health Organization has spoken out about what he says is a general lack of leadership in the fight against coronavirus. And he's again pleading for global unity. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has made the comments as he announced that a former African president and a former New Zealand prime minister would head a panel to assess the world's response to the pandemic. It comes as the death toll in the US alone gets close to 133,000, and senior health officials there warn that their efforts simply aren't working. Barney Porter has been taking a look.
The WHO's Director General was blunt.
In most of the world, the virus is not under control. It's getting worse. More than 11.8 million cases of COVID-19 have now been reported to WHO. More than 544,000 lives have been lost.
Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has announced that the former Liberian President, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and the former New Zealand Prime Minister, Helen Clark, will head a new panel that will provide an honest assessment of the global response to the pandemic and what lessons can be learned for the future. But in the face of the current threat, he's again pleading for global unity.
My friends, make no mistake. The greatest threat we face now is not the virus itself. Rather, it's the lack of leadership and solidarity at the global and national levels.
Mr. Ghebreyesus made no reference to the Trump administration giving formal notice this week the US will leave the UN agency, as a growing number of health officials there warn that the country's health system might be ready to burst. The death toll in the US is approaching 133,000. More bleak assessments, this time from Dr. Anthony Fauci, White House advisor and director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
As a country, when you compare us to other countries, I don't think you can say we're doing great. I mean, we're just not.
Luann Woodward is from the University of Mississippi Medical Center.
We are having right now, our largest surge of patients. I am also convinced that what we're doing now is not working. It is not safe, it is not smart, and it is not effective.
That's not the president's view.
We've done a great job, whether it's ventilators or anything you want to look at, testing. We test so many people that we have more cases.
It's a pretty straightforward argument. More tests will reveal more cases. But according to CNN, the actual number of tests is down and the number of cases is up. In just 4 weeks, the number of cases in the US went from 2 million to 3 million. The nation is currently at the highest 7-day average of cases since the beginning of the pandemic. Long lines are forming again outside testing clinics, and an increasing number of medical facilities are reporting shortages of personal protective gear. Overnight, the White House press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, was pressed by reporters on the growing numbers admitted to hospital.
Hospitalizations in the country are up 50% since mid-June. How can the president say that the country is in good shape right now?
So I would note with hospitalizations in a lot of these hospitals, I spoke with Dr. Birx this morning, about 10 to 40% in the hospitals reaching high capacity are COVID. So a lot of hospitalizations aren't pertaining to COVID. What I would also note, and I'm glad...
Is not because of COVID?
Well, a lot of it is elective surgeries and other surgeries that have opened up.
Luann Woodward again.
Things are not normal and we cannot behave as if they are because we're fooling ourselves.
A final suggestion from Michigan's Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
Make a mask. Make a mask with a political statement saying I hate masks if you want, but just wear it. That's all I ask. That's the kind of thing that can really make a difference. So thank you, everybody. Stay safe. Have a good one.
Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Barney Porter with that report. So as world leaders and health authorities respond to the spread of COVID-19, there's a lot of work happening behind the scenes. Scientists are tracing its origins, the pattern of the outbreak and how it affects different people. Professor Jeremy Nicholson is one of them. He's the director of the Australian National Phenome Centre south of Perth. He's also the Pro Vice Chancellor for Murdoch University's Health Future Institute. We spoke earlier.
The Australian National Phenome Centre was set up late last year as a new laboratory trying to understand gene-environment interactions and where disease risks come from, but also to work with our clinical colleagues to look at the stratification of disease and trying to discover new subtypes of disease so that we can treat patients better. Our centre had only been open for a few months when the corona pandemic crisis emerged. And I made a decision that given this is the most important disease and health threat that we've faced in 100 years or more, that the whole of our resources should be dedicated to fighting the disease and trying to find new diagnostics and potentially information that could lead to cures and new therapeutic interventions.
Yeah, so in that process, I mean, you look at the factors which cause disease, I imagine. So genetics, the environment, lifestyle. Has it been a challenge to study this coronavirus, given how quickly it's spread around the world?
Yeah, and what we really are looking at is a metabolic phenotype. That's all the different chemicals that are in your body, which change according to whether you're well or ill, and they are influenced by what sort of disease you have or in how healthy you are. So we can interpret these complicated patterns in terms of disease risk, or in the case of something like COVID-19, the effect the virus is having on the body. And what it reveals so far is really quite shocking. The virus is much more complex than anything we've ever seen before. Obviously, most people are looking at it from the point of view of the respiratory effects, which are the things that are most obvious and the things that are killing people. But what we're discovering now and others around the world is that it creates a whole lot of other effects too, potentially diabetes, heart risk, liver damage, brain damage. You name it, this one can do it. It is the Pandora's box of diseases.
And when we first heard about it, there was a particular concern for certain groups of the population, so the elderly and people who are immunocompromised. But as you say, it is complex because cases have appeared where seemingly young and healthy people have been severely affected. Some of them have died. Do we know why the disease can vary from mild to severe?
Because the disease is so complex and it has so many facets, it's actually quite difficult to dissect out the exact individual risk factors at the moment. This will emerge. But basically, anything that you've got, this virus seems to make it worse. So if you're a pre-diabetic, you might be pushed in towards diabetes. If you're a diabetic, you can become a double diabetic. If you've got pre-existing lung condition, obviously, then you're going to be compromised with respect to the lung effects. The early studies that came out from China really pointed very strongly towards this being a disease that was mainly affecting the elderly. And that may well be true in China, but as the virus moved out and around the world, younger and younger cohorts of people appear to be affected. It's still true that children are much less at risk than adults.
Yeah.
And the older you get, the more likely you're going to have a problem. But the exact details for each individual is still not understood.
Your centre is also working on a broader international program looking at the natural history. You've described it as a natural history of COVID-19. What do you mean by that? What's its natural history?
Well, the natural history of a disease is understanding where it comes from, what it does and where it goes to. So what we're interested in is how the disease operates biochemically in the population. What's the transition from being healthy to being unwell? What is the hospital journey? That's the time that you are actually in hospital and you're being treated and you can get worse or you can get better. How does that fit in? And what happens when you are recovered, in inverted commas? Are you truly recovered, or are your risks for other diseases changed because of your experience with the virus? So that, if you like, this is the journey from wellness into unwellness to recovery and what that means for you long term. That's the natural history of the disease.
And obviously a long journey ahead for researchers such as yourself. Can I ask you, in the United Kingdom, the National Health Service is going to set up a recovery clinic for patients who are enduring longer term effects of COVID-19. Do we have a sense of how many people are suffering from long-term complications at the moment?
It's emerging, and it's looking quite serious because it appears that some of the complications can occur in people that only have mild respiratory effects. So from the work on SARS, which has been published, there is information that indicated that there is a high proportion of diabetics, a high proportion of people with liver disease, and also, you know, a range of other dysfunctions in the blood. And that hasn't been in attention because SARS only affected a few thousand people. This is a disease, COVID-19, is a disease affecting tens of millions of people.
Yeah.
So if it's anything like SARS, which I truly hope it isn't, then we're going to see a long-term increase in the health burden for the whole of the country. Australia at the moment is still, obviously, has a small number of cases, only just over about 9,000, and very few deaths, only just over 100. But you can think about it as missing the bullet, but in fact, the bullet is still flying. And we've seen already in Melbourne in the last couple of weeks the uptick of the virus. If you let it out, it will proliferate. And until we have a vaccine, which could be a very long time, we're going to be on the back foot for this. It's a very worrying, very worrying disease.
Professor Jeremy Nicholson from the Australian National Phenome Centre in WA. For some of Australia's regional communities, it's been a tough time. First the drought, then the bushfires, and now border closures. As we've been covering on the show, the New South Wales-Victoria border is closed to those without a valid reason to travel. And for many, that sudden change has hit their livelihoods, while for others it's gone relatively smoothly. David Sparks has been speaking to some of those affected.
Every time Jenny Robb thinks her wilderness and camping business is about to recover after the bushfires that swept through southeastern New South Wales, another disaster hits. Based in Kaya, right near the Victorian border and the pristine coastline, she was looking forward to running kayaking tours this winter.
We have had a lot of interest from people from Victoria and Canberra, but mainly Victoria. And unfortunately, I did have some tours booked. They were cancelled pretty much straight away as soon as the border closure was announced.
Yeah, I guess you speak to other people as well in the community. We're a day and a half into the closure now. What's the sort of word on the ground about how well or badly the border closure is working so far?
Friends of mine in the industry who have tours and or accommodation said they had great bookings pre the announcement of the closure. And then when the closure was announced, they just were on the phone with cancellations all day.
In another border community, Karawa, west of Albury, farmer Derek Scone says he's managed to work around the border closure so far.
I'm based on New South Wales. I very rarely have to go into Victoria, but I have heard other farmers that do have workers that reside in Victoria, especially on the first day that when the permit system was only just starting, that a lot of people had trouble crossing, and that's when the big delays started. But now it seems to be moving quite smoothly.
Derek Scone, who's chairman of the New South Wales Cattle Committee, says the closure might affect his work more when he needs to travel for other reasons, such as buying spare parts. But he says the real impact depends a lot on which part of the border you live in.
Further down the river, where the crossings get smaller, some of them have been completely barricaded off. So there are a number of communities in New South Wales that actually their service centre is in Victoria, and they now have an enormous detour to actually access those services.
Another area hit by the closure is the far west of the border. John George runs backpacker hostels in Mildura on the Victorian side of the Murray River. He organises transport for backpackers to get to work on farms, particularly for citrus and grape growers.
For us, yeah, there was a challenge on the first day of the border lockdown in what we should do, and it was a bit of an unknown then. We got them permits that called them cross-border residents, because effectively, if they have no other address, their address is where they're living in Mildura, which is with us at a backpacker place. We gave them a letter for each car that they used, be it their car or our car, to say that they were staying with us. And we said take their passports. And we haven't had it. We've had no issues with them being able to cross the border or come back.
And John George voices another concern raised by many living along the border.
I think that there are people here that find it intensely frustrating that they're forced to do something because of a problem that they think has originated in Melbourne.
John George from Mildura and David Sparks with that report. That's all from the World Today team for this week. The program's producer is Sarah Sedgie. The associate producer is Barney Porter, and technical production by Alan Arthur. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. I'm Thomas Ariti. Thanks very much for your company this week. Have a happy and safe weekend.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. For something that dominates our whole lives, COVID-19 is still pretty poorly understood. Until recently, we at least thought we knew where it came from, but now there's new research suggesting that that might be wrong too.
Today on The Signal, we examine the chances that the virus didn't come from Wuhan at all, that it might have been brought into the city and possibly into China from somewhere else altogether. So will knowing the truth about the origins of the virus help us defeat it? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.